Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. In the history of the American Revolution, two figures stand in stark contrast to each other, George Washington and Benedict Arnold. In the American imagination, Washington is elevated as an example of sterling character, while Arnold is ostracized to the seventh layer of Dante's hell. But what few Americans know is that at the start of the War of Independence, Washington was actually a blundering general, while Arnold was one of the colony's very best. So how is it that Washington transformed himself into one of America's greatest leaders while Arnold ended up betraying his countrymen? Well, that's what my guest today explores in his book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. His name is Nathaniel Philbrick, and today on the show, we discuss the evolution of Washington as a general and a statesman, Benedict Arnold's amazing but often forgotten battlefield exploits for the American cause, and how Arnold's valiant ambition turned into a vain and treacherous appetite that led to his downfall. And along the way, Nathaniel and I just talk about the life lessons we can take from these two eminent revolutionaries. Really great podcast. After the show's over, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/ambition for links to resources that we discussed in the show so you can delve deeper into this topic. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
So your latest book, you've written a lot of great historical books. Your latest one is called Valiant Ambition, where you follow the military careers of two of the Revolutionary War's most well-known names, George Washington and Benedict Arnold. I'm curious, what inspired you to dig into the history of how these men developed into the men that we know of today? How Washington turned into the great general that we know as today, and how Arnold turned into America's most infamous traitor?
Yeah, well, there's really kind of two sources to that. My previous book was called Bunker Hill, which describes, as the title might suggest, the outbreak of the Revolution in the Boston area. And the book sort of ends with the arrival of George Washington, who takes over what will become the Continental Army during the siege of Boston. And it was with the conclusion of that book that I realized I need to follow George Washington. This is not the Washington that peers at us from the dollar bill, you know, sort of the staid pragmatist that looks like the rock upon which this country has been founded. Washington, at the beginning of the Revolution, was in his early 40s, red-haired, fiery, and by natural temperament, very aggressive. He wanted to attack the British that were holed up in Boston, even if this meant burning the city to the ground. He just wanted to end it all in one very risky stroke. And he would repeatedly bring this proposal to his Council of War, and every time the generals would turn it down as basically madness. And you know, this was Washington, I had not grown up with. And so I knew I wanted to follow him. And so the question for me was to who to pair him up with, because I also knew that the middle years of the Revolution were very different from, I think, what most of us assume the Revolution to be, you know, sort of this each battle a stepping stone to God-ordained victory. Instead, the sort of the gas came out of the Revolution, and it became this stalemate in which Americans showed much more interest in fighting themselves than the British. And I thought, how do you get at this dark underbelly? Well, my mother, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, was a huge fan of Benedict Arnold. And my mom was kind of a renegade herself. And she she always said that Arnold had gotten a bum rap, that there were reasons why he did this, and that, you know, your teacher should teach you this. And I'd always say, Mom, Arnold personifies evil. What are you talking about? Well, I am here before you today to say that Mom was right. I realized that, you know, I had this exposure to Arnold as a kid, and I realized that's the guy to go with. That's the guy to pair with Washington. And what I do in Valiant Ambition is follow for 4 years Arnold at his highest, because he was our best battlefield general in the beginning. But he would have his reasons to become increasingly embittered with the American cause, and ultimately 4 years later, he would decide to turn traitor. And so I wanted to follow those two very different characters along very different paths.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It really opened my eyes to some kind of assumptions that I had. I mean, you even start the book, you know, it was going back to Washington. You talk about how, I think one of the secretaries of the Continental Congress, he had these, like, yeah, a journal, and where he talked about, like, you know, sort of the foibles of Washington. And he thought about publishing them, but at that time, you know, Washington had already been, you know, the apotheosis of Washington had already happened, and we had this myth, and he just, like, no, I can't undo this myth. It's good for the country. So he didn't publish it. So you said, yeah, Washington at the very beginning of the war lacked a bit of military acumen, didn't have that sort of pragmatic approach that he had. So, you know, are there any specific examples where you talk about in the book, the 4 years you discuss, where Washington, showed a lack of military acumen that actually hurt the revolutionary cause?
Yeah. Well, I mean, from really where the book begins, which is just after the Siege of Boston, the British now have turned their sights on New York. And Washington is dug into New York and the high ground in Brooklyn on Long Island. And the British have thrown a huge force at America, 400 vessels, 34,000 sailors and soldiers. This is the largest invasionary force Britain will mount until World War I. I mean, it's just a huge, huge army that Washington has to deal with. And he had no experience leading a large army in battle. No one in the American army had that kind of experience. And as I said before, he was by temperament aggressive. And even though his army was completely overmatched by the British, he was determined to fight. And so he puts his army in a very risky position in Long Island, and he's completely outgeneraled by his British counterpart, General Howe, in a flanking maneuver. And Howe had the opportunity to completely destroy Washington's army, but for the Howe brothers, because his older brother was the admiral that was in charge of the British fleet, were hopeful that they could humiliate the American army to the point that they were forced to negotiate a peace. They really felt that by destroying the American army, they would hopelessly embitter the American people and ultimately make reconciliation impossible. And so you could argue that if not for Howe, Washington would have probably lost his army right there at the Battle of Long Island. Howe gave him the opportunity to escape at night in a brilliant retreat across the East River. And eventually, yet he persisted in hanging out in New York and trying to defend that. Ultimately, he would be forced to retreat. He would have that great comeback at Trenton and Princeton. But the following year, when he was defending Philadelphia from Howe's army that was now marching towards Philadelphia, which is the seat of the Continental Congress, once again, Washington at the battles of Brandywine and Germantown surrenders to his naturally aggressive side, and as a consequence, puts his army in very dangerous positions and suffers reversals that ultimately allow the British to take Philadelphia. And it's only after this, in the winter of 1777-78, while he's holed up at Valley Forge, that Washington begins to realize, okay, I really need to commit to a different kind of strategy. I want to fight, but this is not the best thing for my country, given the state of the army. I need to fight a defensive war, a war of attrition, what he calls a war of posts. And it's not what he wants to do. It's not the way he's wired, but it's the way he will then proceed for the next years of the War of Independence. And it's kind of extraordinary. And there are very few leaders who can go against the very essence of who they are because they know it's the right thing to do. And Washington was one of those unusual people.
And that's the moment when he turned into the pragmatic George Washington we know today. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the things that, you know, he had his weaknesses as a military commander, but he was an absolute genius as a politician. And so what happens is as the war devolves into a stalemate where, you know, each battle really doesn't do much to move anything in any direction, it's Washington's ability to deal with politicians, with officers who are infighting. It's his political skills that really rise to the fore, and it's he emerges as that one person capable of holding all of this together.
Yeah, there is great examples of that political skill in action where I think Washington intercepted a note where one of the generals was bad mouthing him. And he saw it, and then he passed it along to the guy that was supposed to get it, and he left a note, kind of sort of passive aggressive, you know, and it really shut the whole thing down. Everyone just backed away.
Absolutely. Right. And this is during the terrible retreat across New Jersey in the fall of 1776. You know, he's at his absolute lowest point. Trenton is to come in just a month's time, but at this point, you know, he's at his lowest. And it's correspondence for Joseph Reed, his adjutant general, the person upon whom he depends the most, the closest person in his military family. Reed is away from headquarters, so Washington opens it and learns that Reed, unknown to him, has been in correspondence with Charles Lee, the second-ranking general in the American Army, and complaining about Washington for his indecisiveness and suggesting to Lee that come winter, that Lee go south and organize a new army, you know, and so this is not good news. And for most people, it would be crushing news that would probably inspire a good amount of anger. Washington doubtless felt that anger, but instead of outwardly expressing it, he does something. He's brilliant. He reseals the letter and sends it to Reed with an accompanying note saying, assuming this came for you, assuming it was official business, I opened it as usual, realizing it was something else, my apologies. And he leaves Reed to twist in the icy emptiness of his withheld wrath. And man, does he get the message. And this is just, those are the political skills that would really serve him and our country so well in the years to come.
Yeah. And not only did Washington have this fiery temperament that wanted him to cause, you know, he wanted to attack all the time, but I guess throughout the book, this whole idea of valiant ambition is, all these generals had it in spades. And there was this social pressure to fight with honor and to show yourself a man. And so I imagine that was a lot of the pressure that Washington felt too, but he had to say, you know, I'm not going to take part in that. I'm going to switch to this other strategy because it's for the good of the country.
Right, and it killed him because, you know, many of his own officers would say, you know, what are you doing? You know, why isn't he going after them? Politicians who really had no clue as to what was going on militarily, but, you know, just wanted things to go as well as possible, criticized him, and so it was a very difficult position to take, and yet ultimately, after, you know, 2 years of learning it the hard way, he committed to it, and you know, it's you know, it's the ultimate, you know, it's so easy to surrender to our impulses in a fit of anger and pique, you know, but Washington learned, nope, I'm going to take the higher ground. I am going to keep the long view ahead of me, and we really owe the fact that we have a country to Washington's strength of character in this regard.
So the guy you juxtaposed Washington to was Benedict Arnold. And this is a guy who seemed like who couldn't put a check on his temperament and his ambition. Yeah. What's interesting in the book, though, like as you said, we had this idea that Benedict Arnold, he was born a traitor. Like he was born, like, he was predestined to go to Dante's seventh layer of hell.
Right, exactly.
But you highlight in great detail before Arnold turned into a traitor, he was one of America's great Revolutionary War generals. I think this is forgotten. So can you take us through some of Arnold's contributions to the American cause before he committed treason?
I mean, it's kind of amazing. In the first years of the Revolution, there was no one better on the battlefield than Arnold. I mean, he learns of Lexington and Concord, and he's in New Haven, and he realizes that at the southern end of Lake Champlain is Fort Ticonderoga, a lightly held British fortress that contains all of these cannons that would be of huge help to the American cause, and it's also an important strategic point. And so he proposes to the officials in Boston that he take Fort Ticonderoga. By this time, others have heard about the idea, and he ends up having to team up with Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, and they famously, side by side, take Fort Ticonderoga. And then while Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys are getting drunk on the British liquor supply, Arnold commandeers a Loyalist schooner, sails up the full 100-mile length of Lake Champlain and attacks a small British force at St. John's in Canada and takes what vessels they have, destroys what he can't take with him, and now America has command of Lake Champlain, an absolutely essential quarter of water that we need to command. And so he does that, and then he then goes to Boston, where now Washington is the commander of the American army. Washington's stuck in the siege of Boston, but he sends Arnold on an impossible mission to try to take Quebec, and this requires him to go overland through Maine. I've actually followed Arnold's trail through the backwoods of Maine. There's still nothing up there to this day. If there's a signpost, it has Arnold's name on it because he was apparently the last person to go through there. But he loses a third of his soldiers to desertion and death, staggers out of the wilderness, and is there at Quebec. He's heralded as the American Hannibal. He's ultimately unsuccessful in taking Quebec, no fault of his own. He's grievously injured, but he pulls himself together. And then in the fall of 76, he fights the Battle of Valcour Island, the greatest naval battle that no one's ever heard of, fought on Lake Champlain. And Washington has lost New York by this time. Arnold, by preventing the British from taking Fort Ticonderoga, saves America. Because if they had taken that fort and linked up with Howe in New York, it would have all been over. And so then that leads a year later to the Battle of Saratoga, the great victory in which the French are convinced to come into the war on our side. And it was Arnold's soldiers that were responsible for it. And so there's really no one, short of Washington, who's doing more than Arnold to do all this. And as you said, he was passionate. He couldn't control himself the way Washington could when he was off the battlefield. But man, our country owed him a lot in the first years of the Revolution.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a thoroughly modern design. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, and the interior is built with robust materials and integrity. The Defender capability is legendary, whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions. The Defender 110 lets you go further and do more. It's built for the modern explorer. They've got lots of cargo space, so you've got plenty of room for your gear. They also have powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system that keeps you connected, and they have an innovative camera technology system that delivers unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. It is ready for a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. A vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. There are millions of workers, but there's only one you, with only one body. So why wear it down with lesser power tools? You deserve ease. You deserve safety. You deserve Bosch. With Bosch tools, you can raise the X-Lock, hammer drill, or 2-in-1 with pride and know that you deserve it. Now lower it, safety first. Bosch tools, what hard workers deserve. Did you know Fast-Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast-Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast-Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had it cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned this bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast-Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. But I guess where the seeds of Arnold's, you know, treasonous, you know, his treasonous decision was, he had these great victories, but it seemed like he perceived that he wasn't getting the due respect that he thought he deserved from other generals and also from the Continental Congress. So, I mean, what were some of these slights that Arnold experienced from these generals that, you know, kind of sowed the his treason?
Yeah, there are really two events that had a lot to do with it. The first was after stopping the British from taking Fort Ticonderoga at the Battle of Valcour, he was up for promotion. He was our highest-ranking brigadier general with the best record. But the Continental Congress that reserved the right to pick major generals determined that each state should get two of them. And since Arnold's home state of Connecticut already had two, he would be overlooked, and five generals who ranked below him would be elevated past him to major general. And, you know, this angered him. It would have angered anyone, and it greatly upset Washington, who realized that Arnold was his best battlefield general at this time. And so this began his questioning, you know, why am I doing this? He had also given a lot of his personal fortune to the cause in those first years in Canada, and the Continental Congress showed no interest in compensating him. But it would really be at the Battle of Saratoga in October of 1777, where Arnold would suffer the experience that would really start his spiral down into treason. His commanding officer was Horatio Gates, who was concerned that Arnold, with his reputation for aggressiveness and success on the battlefield, was a threat to stealing the glory from him. And what Gates did was instigate a blow-up with Arnold. There were two battles to the Battle of Saratoga. In the first, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, it would be Arnold's soldiers that delivered a devastating blow to the British and sent them reeling. And in his official account of the battle, Gates chose not to mention Arnold. And Gates knew Arnold very, very well, had been with him on Lake Champlain the previous year, and knew just what buttons to push when it came to a guy of such a passionate nature. And so they have this violent argument, and Arnold is out of the Northern Army. This, however, does not prevent him from appearing on the battlefield in the final climactic battle of Bemis Heights. And it's Arnold, at the very end, leads this amazing charge to the entrance, rear entrance of a British redoubt, enters on his horse, waving his sword, commands him to surrender, and he is shot with a musket ball fired by a German soldier that fractures his left thigh, kills his horse, which collapses on top of his injured leg. And he's just lying there, and one of his young officers from New Hampshire, who'd been with him since Quebec, comes up to him and says, "Are you badly hurt?" And he says, "In the left leg, I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart." You know, he knew that his left leg was going to be in very bad shape. He was going to be in a hospital bed for months ahead, and Gates was going to be the hero of Saratoga. And so it really, you know, why am I doing this? You know, he would eventually spend that winter in a hospital bed in Albany. The leg that would emerge from the fracture box that they attached to it would be 2 inches shorter. It would be more than a year before he could walk unassisted. And he began to wonder, you know, why am I doing this? Continental Congress doesn't give me the respect I deserve. By that time, they'd give him his promotion, but it was too little, too late. Gates had, you know, messed with his head, and he had suffered this terrible, debilitating physical injury. And it was as much a psychic wound as it was a physical injury. And so he began to wonder, why am I doing this? And this began his gradual creep towards treason.
And I think the other thing you really do a good job of highlighting in the book is that underneath these slights that Arnold was experiencing that contributed to his, you know, decision to become a traitor, was that during this time of the war, like as you said earlier, the colonies were fighting each other basically, and they were like their own worst enemies. So how did that acrimony that existed between the colonies also contribute to his decision to commit treason?
Yeah, because, you know, there was, you know, a war against Great Britain, but there was also a civil war going on, and the American people were showing much more interest in fighting each other than the British. And as Arnold's becoming increasingly bitter about his own treatment, he's watching his country falling apart. The Continental Congress does not have the power to tax the American people directly, so Washington's army doesn't have the funds it needs to fight. And by the fall of 1780, it really looks like if somehow Washington can win this war, will there be a country left to claim victory? I mean, you know, we now look back and see this as God ordained, but in the middle of it, it looked like the American people had really turned their backs on the vow they had made to one another with the Declaration of Independence. And so from Arnold's point of view, he began to think, well, since the Continental Congress is no one to trust when it comes to the welfare of this country, it's time to bring the British back. We've defaulted on the pledge we made to ourselves. Let's bring the British back to restore the freedoms we enjoyed before this misbegotten revolution. And so from his standpoint, what the others would regard as an act of treason, an attempt to sell West Point to the British, he saw it as an act of patriotism. You know, that it was up to someone like him to restore the government that had been, you know, fallen, and because the American people had proven incapable of governing themselves.
So, at what point did Arnold decide to betray his country? And I thought this was interesting too. What role did his wife play in his betrayal?
Yeah. Well, you know, Arnold, spouses have a big influence on how people think. And Arnold, was the hero of Saratoga. They had been forced to evacuate with the entrance of France after the Battle of Saratoga. They needed to consolidate their forces in New York. And so Arnold became the commander of this war-torn city where there was literally fighting in the streets between patriots and more conservative, loyalist-leaning citizens. And Arnold, being the controversial person he was soon surrounded in controversy. He was really unhappy with what was going on in the country and personally, but he had fallen in love. A girl literally half his age, 18-year-old Peggy Shippen. He was 36, a widower with three young sons. And they fell in love. And her father, her family was well-to-do Philadelphians who had royal connections prior to the Revolution. During the British occupation, she and her sisters had enjoyed socializing with the British officers, one of whom, Major John Andre, had done a sketch of her that just shows how beautiful a woman she really was. And within a month of their marriage, Arnold would send his first feelers to the British, who are now in New York, and that feeler would go to none other than Major John Andre, the officer whom Peggy had befriended and who would become the British spy chief. And over the next year and a half, they would negotiate back and forth with Arnold wangling command of West Point, the most important fortress in America, and scheming to turn that over to the British.
And so he made that decision to give over West Point. It failed. I mean, it was kind of, I guess we won't go into this because we're almost out of time, but like how it failed was, it just seemed like it was like pure chance and pure luck that this...
Absolutely. You know, well, the thing about Arnold, you know, he was a good battlefield general, and he was pretty darn good as a scheming traitor. You know, he had been in negotiations for more than a year, and yet the very extensive spy network that Washington and others had put together had no notion, no clue of what Arnold was trying to do. And he and Andre meet at night on the banks of the Hudson River, exchange the documents that are crucial to the taking of West Point. It's all about to happen. Andre needs to get back to British-occupied New York to make it happen, but he's captured by three militiamen. And it's only that foiled what might have been the plot that ended, that made Great Britain victorious.
Yeah. But then what I thought was interesting in the book is that you argue that Arnold committing treason was probably the best thing that could have happened to the Americans. Why was his treason such a boon to the revolutionary cause?
Well, you know, by the fall of 1780, the American war effort had cratered. It seemed like the American people had just given up. They weren't willing. They hadn't been willing to pay taxes to the British. Now they weren't willing to pay the taxes required to fund the army needed to win them independence. And they were fracturing into 13 independent polities, you know, instead of functioning as a country. But it was the revelation of Arnold's betrayal. This great hero who had tried to turn over West Point to the British. This was had a galvanizing effect. Arnold would be burned in effigy in towns up and down the Eastern Seaboard. This was a true wake up call. And I don't think it's an accident that within a year's time, America would enjoy the incredible victory at Yorktown that would make the victory of war in the War of Independence inevitable. And it's interesting, Arnold would become a British brigadier general and be sent down to Virginia. And Washington was by this time very angry with Arnold and making it a real personal cause to get him, sent Lafayette, the French general upon whom had become a virtual son to him, down to get him. And this begins the movement of troops that would ultimately culminate in the great victory at Yorktown. So I think ultimately you could argue that in the early years of the Revolution, Arnold did more than anyone short of Washington for America, but it was as a traitor that he really made possible ultimate victory.
My guest today was Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of the book Valiant Ambition. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, if you want to delve deeper into this topic, check out our show notes at aom.is/ambition. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd appreciate if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.